Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Greg Kokel here, and the show is Stand to Reason. Thank you for being my guest today as we talk about the critical issues of life, ethics, values, and religion with you every Sunday, 3 to 5. 1-800-227-5278 up and down the West Coast. Actually, that's the number over the whole country. And here in the 714 area code, Orange County, 754-4150. Those are the numbers to get the enforcer to get me. And lines are open. So the show is for you this weekend. No interviews, no guests except for you. 1-800-227-5278. And in the 714 area code, once again, 754-4150. I just got off the airplane from Georgia. And boy, it is nice there now. I came back to this Santa Ana condition heat, and it was a rainstorm when I left there, and all the trees were all leafy and green. It's springtime there. It's actually beginning of summer, and I was out in the country where I stayed. I did a debate there at Columbia State University in the city of Columbia, about an hour and a half south of Atlanta, and then did a seminar over the weekend with a church there on various aspects of defending the faith. In fact, it's called Who Are You to Say? And, you know, there are two things that – well, actually, before I get into the spiritual stuff, I've got to tell you that on a personal note, when I go to Georgia, I always bring my fishing poles. And so I left a day early from L.A. to get there and did a little fishing. As it turns out, both days that I fished, Thursday during the day, the debate was Thursday night, and then Friday during the day, and then I started the conference Friday night. Neither of those days were really good fishing. I fished mostly private ponds, and I had some good friends that I had met last time there, and we went out fishing together, and it was just a lot of fun. But the fishing wasn't that good. It wasn't that fast and furious, with one exception. Because the fishing was slow on Friday, we'd only gotten three or four fish in the boat. By the time it was almost time for us to leave, we only put a half day in. There was a stump right in the middle of this 70-acre lake, very shallow lake, but it has a lot of good bass in it. There was a big stump right in the middle of that lake. And by the way, now I hear myself in my headphones, and I hear just a little bit of Georgia accent coming through when I'm talking to this fishing story. In any event, I put on a Senko, which is a plastic bait that looks like a pen, like a fat pen that's made out of plastic. This one was black, and I put a hook in it, and when you throw it out, you don't do anything with it. You just let it sink, and it kind of sashays down, and the fish like that slow sashaying, sinking look to it, and if it hits the bottom, it doesn't get bit. Well, you pull it up, and you cast it again to some other target. Well, I put this bait on, and I told my friends, now you watch this. My friend Jim Money, I said, Jim, you watch this bait. Now, I want you to watch this fancy retrieve. You got to watch my pole tip real carefully because I got to put this really special fancy retrieve on this, and you got to get it right. And so I cast this bait out, and it hit the water, and I sat there like a statue and let that bait sink because that's all the action you put on it. There wasn't any action at all. And all of a sudden, 3 seconds later, that line just took off, and I had a big fish on. Started jumping side the boat, and it was the biggest fish I'd had, the biggest bass. I knew this was a personal best. This was a big fish. It came right at me after it took the bait. I'm reeling like crazy to take up the slack. Then it blows by the boat and launches into the air, and Jim Money had one bit of advice for me. He said, don't lose that fish. Oh, thanks. And that fish immediately sounded. That means he went down and went under the boat, and then I heard a couple of big kablooshes. That means that big fish was jumping on the opposite side of the boat. I couldn't see it. It was to my back. My boat rod was doubled over going underneath the boat. And that means if my rod is doubled over on one side and the fish is jumping on the other side, that means that line is running on the rubbing on the keel of the boat. Not just one time kabloosh, but two times kabloosh before I finally got him over on my side again and around the motor. And finally, and yes, I know you're waiting for, and the line snapped, and it popped out of its mouth. No, it didn't. I pulled him alongside. I got my thumb in his mouth and hauled him on board. So I caught this fish, and I put the scales to him, and he's 7 pounds, 3 ounces, a largemouth bass. That's my personal best. And so I got to tell you my fish story. This is not the one that got away, and we even got some photos of it too. So I haven't seen the photos yet, but Jim Money had a old camera in his pack, and so he took a couple shots, and I'll get those in a week or two. But that was – I can't say that was the highlight of the trip because there are – we had spiritual – we had bigger fish to fry, let's put it that way. And this one I didn't fry. I let him go. I mean, I'm a catch-and-release guy. That's why it took me so long to get married, some people say. Finally, I met my wife, and I didn't release her. Anyway, there were, as I said, we had bigger fish to fry, and I did a debate on Thursday night, and then I taught during the week. And something happened in the debate that I want to bring to your attention before I get to your calls. 1-800-227-5278. By the way, line's open there. And something else happened on the airplane on my way back from Georgia, from the Atlanta leg. To Los Angeles, and there was a woman that was sitting next to me I got into a short conversation with. And in both cases, I learned a lesson, or at least what was said in both cases exemplified a pattern that I see in society. Now, here's the pattern, that people are deeply socialized to believe particular things, even if they don't have any good reason to believe it. All right? In the debate, we had our debate, and the gentleman that I was debating, Jonathan Holland, was my opponent, and we both were engaged in Q&A after the event. And questions came up from the audience, many of them directed at Jonathan about the coherence of his view. Now, the debate was on moral relativism. I was arguing the moral realist view, the moral objectivist view. There are moral principles in the world. Jonathan was arguing there aren't, and he had two lines of argument. These are the standard ways that people argue this issue against me. First, he made the observation that people have different points of view when it comes to morality. Now, for some reason, this seems to be axiomatic proof that morality, therefore, must be relative. You have different cultures with different point of view. Different people have different points of view. Therefore, morality isn't universal. Well, a thing could be universal for, universal for everybody, but not necessarily universally evident to everybody. The principles of math are universal, and they are universal for everybody. But it doesn't mean that people don't get their sums wrong. Sometimes we don't balance our checkbook, so we can make mistakes. For some reason, he was under the impression that if it wasn't universally agreed on, it couldn't have been a universal truth. Well, that's a major mistake, of course. But in any event, that was his line of argument. It was interesting in the process of his line of argument, his second point, the first one being people disagree, and of course it doesn't follow that because people disagree, then therefore there is no objective moral principle or moral law. His second line of argument was that by way of explaining the moral project, he said it's up to societies to decide. Societies say what's right and what's wrong. What's good and what's bad is a matter of consensus, and so in that sense the majority rules. Now, I raised the problem of the moral reformer, and under those circumstances, there can't be a majority of one. And he just disagreed with me, though obviously there's no grounds to disagree. Listen, friends, if society is what determines what's moral, then the terms good and bad are grounded in social consensus. Once you get a majority on any view, that is what good means. And the minority is bad, okay? That's his view, not mine. But that's what you're stuck with on this way of looking at it. The problem, of course, is you can't have a minority of one. By definition, the majority is right. And so if you have some individual or group of individuals that are trying to stand against the moral opinion, they can't do so on moral grounds. Martin Luther King can't say that racism is wrong when the majority thinks it's fine. All he can do is appeal for change, and then once the change happens, for what reason I don't know, because there's no grounds of appeal there on that view, once the change takes place and people change their view, then the morality of racism changes from being good because people say it's good to being bad because people say it's bad. On this view, when the opinion changes, the morality of the action changes. Now, this is wildly counterintuitive. It seems that moral reformers, people like Martin Luther King, were moral precisely because they stood against the majority. But on this view, that can't be the case. Now, in the context of my conversation, though, in my own presentation, one way that I argue for moral absolutes is I give clear case examples and show the price that a person has to pay in order to deny objective morality. That price being they have to look at something like rape and torture and say this is morally benign in itself. It is only wrong for certain cultures who think it's wrong. The example that I gave was a 2020 report from a year ago, and I read from the transcript of that 2020 segment about rape and torture and rape used as torture in Saddam Hussein's Iraq prior to the war. Now, having done that, my opponent apparently took this as a justification for the Iraqi war, which it wasn't. It was just a convenient example of a gruesome act that a relativist must dismiss as morally benign if he's going to be consistent with his view. I wasn't saying anything about the war in Iraq, but this gave him opportunity during his rebuttal then to cast aspersions on the legitimacy of the war, which wasn't the purpose of the debate, and I thought wasted time, though he was very, very careful, I noticed, not to make any direct moral comments about the war. Partly, I think, and he did mention this, because I had said in my opening remarks to the audience that one way that we can determine whether they're moral principles or not is whether I give examples, clear case examples, of moral principles, like rape is wrong, or my opponent smuggles morality into his argument against objective morality that I was offering. So if he says, you know, there is no objective morality and people who think there is are intolerant and we should not be intolerant, you can see there he is using objective morality to argue against objective morality. And then it sounds suspiciously like objective morality exists. Well, in his case, he was careful since I warned the audience and he is standing there listening to me when I offer the warning to try very hard not to smuggle terms in. Now, they always do. I've never been in a debate where they didn't do that. But in this particular case, he was careful not to say that the Iraqi war was wrong, even though it was really clear from the nature of his comments that he thought that was the case. Right? Now, this puts him in an untenable position. And the untenable position is this culture, the American culture right now, is, by and large, in favor of the war in Iraq. There are a lot of naysayers, of course, but we still have a majority on our side. Now, on his view that morality is determined by culture, some of you can see this coming already, that means that the war in Iraq is a moral war since the majority happens to agree that it is, which would mean any dissent, any moral reformers with regards to the war would be immoral by definition. That's the liability of that view. And I pointed that out in my opening remarks. However, my opponent was against the war. Well, it seemed that he was. And so during the Q&A, though we weren't cross-examining each other, it was a more informal portion of the debate. The proper portion was behind us. Now we're standing at the edge of the stage, each fielding questions from the audience. And I just happened to ask him in the context of another discussion, was he against the war in Iraq? And he said, yes, he was. He thought it was wrong. Well, of course, now his doom is sealed, because all it took was for me to point out that on his view, since the majority agreed with the war in Iraq, that would make the war in Iraq moral and that those who oppose the war would be immoral by definition, again, on his view. And was he willing then to say and to admit that his view of the war was now immoral on his view? Well, I mean, the jig was up at that point, and the audience knew it, and I think that Jonathan knew it, although he tried to scramble in certain ways trying to get out of it. There was no way out. And what's amazing to me is that and here I start out talking about these things that are absorbed by us in culture, these concepts that we absorb, and we accept them uncritically. And so everybody around him thinks that morality is relative to the culture. This, of course, is obvious, and he gave his reasons why that was the case, and he attempted to argue for that, even against my counterexamples in the debate. It never occurred to him that his own moral position against the war could not be sustained based on the view of the received tradition that he had gotten in college and he was defending there in the debate. It never occurred to him. In other words, I'm fairly certain that rather than accepting this view reflectively, he had this view reflexively. It was just a reaction. He absorbed it from his environment. In fact, there was another example of this. That is, just in a knee-jerk reaction, stating the politically correct position without giving any thought to it whatsoever. Somebody came to the microphone and said, "Jonathan, do you believe in absolute truth?" And he said immediately, not a breath, right on the tails of the question, "No, there is no truth," just like that. Now, why did he say that? Because that's what he'd been taught. That's the politically correct thing to say. Had he thought about it? He couldn't have thought about it, because the next comment from the questioner was, "Is that true?" Further, I'm sorry for chuckling, but it was so I don't mean to be unkind to the gentleman, but it was just so foolish a thing to say. And then, of course, I pointed out, when I got a chance to respond to the question that he had trouble with himself, and to put my own two cents in, the fact is he's at a debate. He is one of the debaters. He is opposing my view. Why does he oppose my view? Because he doesn't think my view is what? True. And it isn't that he doesn't think my view is not true because there is no truth. He thinks my view is not true because it's contrary to his view, which he thinks is correct. In other words, true. To be in a debate, you must argue the other person is wrong and you're right. If you're arguing that you are right, that means your view is so. If it's so, it's true. And if it's true, then you can't say in the same debate that there is no truth. And culture, people in our culture, or I should say that the population is thick with those people in our culture who, whether they're Christians or non-Christians, by the way, repeat the politically correct statements for their respective groups, Christian or non-Christian, reflexively and not reflectively. And this was such a clear example of that, I had to pass it on to you. Open lines in the Orange County area code 714-754-4150 is the number. When I return, I'll take your calls right here on your source for clear thinking Christianity. Stand to reason.
Did you know that the old car, truck, boat, or RV that is gathering dust in your garage can actually change the lives of Christians around the world? By donating your used vehicle to Stand to Reason, you can help develop training materials that will build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. Don't worry if it won't start. We'll tow it away at no charge and help you with all the paperwork. And when we leave, you'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car. Transform your old vehicle into practical training for Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
Have you ever wished you could articulate your faith and beliefs more clearly? Do you feel confident when talking with friends and coworkers about sensitive subjects like abortion and homosexuality? Call today to request the latest issue of Solid Ground, our bi-monthly newsletter. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you represent your faith, even when discussing the most timely and heated of subjects like evolution, cloning, and stem cell research. Now you can avoid feeling uneasy or embarrassed when you want to stand stand up as a Christian ambassador. Simply pick up the phone and call Stand to Reason today. Don't get caught by surprise. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will teach you how to represent your faith as an ambassador of Christ in a concise and attractive manner. Contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at www.str.org. Just request our newsletter called Solid Ground. We'll send it to you free when you call 1-800-2-REASON.
Listen, where do you get this nonsense?
I'm a traveling man.
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason. Live and lively here this hot Sunday afternoon in Southern California. And time to take your calls. Orange County line's open, by the way, in the 714 area code. You can dial direct, 754-4150. Let's go to Greg. Greg, this is Greg.
Hi, Greg. I'm a big fan of your ministry.
Thank you.
And I sometimes have conversations with non-believing friends. And they know where I stand, and I know where they stand. And they ask a classic question, which is, well, how do you know the Bible is true?
Mm-hmm.
And I usually respond by saying, well, you know, the Bible is unique in its history. It's written over a period of 1,500 years by, I'd say, approximately 40 different writers. And it itself claims to be the Word of God, mm-hmm. inspired by God. But you know, it doesn't seem as strong an argument as it could
right.
be, and I was wondering how you'd answer that
question. Yeah, I wouldn't go down that road. I'd start asking some other questions. I'd say, what do you mean by true? I mean, it could be a lot of different things. You could mean that the theological claims are true. Could mean that it works for me. It could mean that the history is true. It's not even – do you see what I'm saying? There's an ambiguity there in the word true. And so what I'd want to do, rather than let them drop this thing on me to respond to, the area is so broad to respond to, I need to narrow it down a little bit. And also I suspect that when people say, how do you know the Bible's true, this is a fairly aggressive challenge. And so there's sometimes a little bit of edge in it. And so if I can start asking them questions and drawing them out, this will make it a little bit more conversational and take some of the edge off of it, okay? Right now they've got an advantage. I mean, if we're talking about something and this issue comes up and all of a sudden they hammer me with this, this is like a surprise attack. So boom, they've got me. And I'm a little off balance, or I might be in principle. And so I want to buy some time. Or you want to buy some time, or anybody does. And I want to take some of the edge off the conversation. Plus, I want more information. So the first use of the Columbo tactic, as you know, is to gather information because sometimes you need more information to know where to go. I'm not exactly sure what's motivating them in this. I'm not sure if they're – I want to feel them out a little bit more. Do they mean history or do they mean whatever? I don't know. So I'm going to say, I'm glad to answer you or to try to answer your question, but it's a bit ambiguous. When you say, how do you know it's true, what do you mean by true? I mean, in what sense are you asking regarding the issue of truth? Go ahead, Greg.
Okay, what led to their question was a couple of books. One was The Da Vinci Code, and then was another one where it supposedly says that a lot of the information of the Bible is false, and it was written by a guy who supposedly had done a lot of research to convince himself
right.
of that fact. And I don't recall the name of the book, but both these guys had read the book, and they go, you know, you really should read this book. And so they were now convinced the Bible is false.
Well, how do they know that this author is telling the truth?
Well, what one friend said was that he had researched it for a number of years.
Wait, who had researched it for a number of years?
The author.
Well, that's circular. My question was, how do you know that the author is telling the truth? Maybe he's lying about researching for 100 years, for many years rather, not 100 years. I mean, how do they know that his research is sound? Yeah, I mean, these are questions that it's fair to ask. You know what this is? I mean, and I'll get to your question. I mean, I'm not trying to avoid the question, but what I'm trying to show is there's a couple of things. First of all, there's an ambiguity in the question to begin with, and then now you've given me more information, but this raises questions in my mind. Here these guys have taken a modern-day author, Dan Brown, who is not even a specialist in the field. He's a novelist. And they are taking him, and I don't know this other guy that they've read, but let's just use Dan Brown for an example here. They are taking Dan Brown, pardon the phrase, as gospel. And they are challenging the authority of the Bible. Now, it's fine. I have no problem with anybody challenging the authority of the Bible, but it strikes me there's a little inequity here. You've got 2,000 years of not only usefulness of the Scriptures, but scholarship. I bet you there is more written about the Bible than any other book ever known to man. Massive amounts of scholarship. And what they are doing is they are dismissing it out of hand simply because Dan Brown says so. Now, it seems to me it's reasonable to ask the same question of Dan Brown that they are asking of the Bible. How do you know Dan Brown's facts are facts? Have you ever read any critiques of Dan Brown's work by scholars in the field? Or have you just read about Dan Brown's fictitious scholar in his fictitious story who tells you what the facts actually are? This is a question they need to answer, and it's a fair one. I mean, I can give you responses with regards to my understanding of the Bible and why I think it's confident, why it's reliable. But I think that if there are the challenge is arising because there is a contrary witness, as it were, in the writings of Dan Brown, I think it's fair to say, what is the credibility of Dan Brown to speak authoritatively on this subject? Does that sound fair?
Yes, it does.
And the same is true about the other person, by the way. Listen, I have dozens of friends that have advanced degrees. I'm talking PhDs or multiple PhDs that have spent their life researching these things and have concluded the authority that the Bible is reliable on a number of different counts. That is, it's true, but of course you have to talk about the specific ways in which you say it's true. And I think we just lost Greg, and so I'm going to say goodbye to Greg here and drop him. And Greg, if you want to call back to finish up here, you're welcome to, but I'll continue with my response. By the way, I didn't do that. Did we do that? No, that's on your end. Okay. And anyway, I wouldn't hang up on myself, right? Okay. So I have dozens of friends that have advanced degrees, as I said, that have done thorough study on this. I've read their books. I have talked to them personally. I know their academic credentials and their personal integrity. And so I'm not the least bit inclined to be strung out because some naysayer says he's been researching it for years. All we have is one researching it for years against many who've researched it for years. All right? So what needs to be done here with the gentlemen in question who are challenging the issue of the Bible being true is to compare notes. How does the arguments being offered by Dan Brown in his fictitious novel, I guess novels are fictitious by nature, his fictitious novel, the Da Vinci Code, and the other gentleman who has written a book debunking the Bible, who has done years of research, how do his argument, their arguments stand up against peer review? That is, other people in the field who are well positioned to know the facts and give responses to their arguments. I'll tell you, I know what it is with Dan Brown. They demolish Dan Brown. They destroy Dan Brown. Dan Brown hasn't got a single leg to stand on. Even the most liberal critics of the Bible don't hold Dan Brown's views. He is, the cheese stands alone there. So, as I know, it sold 60 million books in a year. That's quite a feat. Big deal. That just means 60 million people and or more have been misled by Dan Brown's fictitious novel. So, ladies and gentlemen, when you're facing these kinds of things, you got to compare the facts. That's all it is. It's not just one book. Oh, I read one book. Oh, he researched it a lot. Well, I got dozens of people that I know personally that have researched. I've researched it a lot. I'd like to see the arguments that they make that show that the Bible is not true. Now, this, of course, then goes to the question, what exactly do you mean by true? Probably the most vulnerable way that Christians are I should say the way that the Bible is most vulnerable is on the issue of inerrancy. That is, there are no errors of any kind in the Bible. Every single thing the Bible says is true. Frankly, ladies and gentlemen, I don't argue inerrancy with non-believers. It's not necessary. This is an in-house discussion. I believe in inerrancy, okay? But I don't expect a non-believer to believe in it. And I don't have to have inerrancy in order to prove the truth of Christianity. All I need is an historically reliable Bible. Now, is he telling me that the gospel accounts are not historically reliable? Is that what this gentleman who says the Bible isn't true is averring? Well, that depends on, I should say, that relies on a person's understanding about how the historical method works and an analysis of the gospel accounts in light of their historical accuracy and the details and the canons of historical assessment that one applies to any work of antiquity to find out if it's sound. The problem is when you apply those canons in an unbiased way. In other words, you don't make special demands on the Bible that you don't make on other books of the same kind. Well, the Bible's going to come out with very high marks in terms of historical accuracy. The problem is people go in there with biases. They say, well, first of all, we got to cast all the miracle stuff. This is bogus. Why? Because miracles don't happen. Well, see, that's cheating. So you have to ask what nature of truth or what truth claim about the Bible is under attack here. I think the Bible is historically true. I have good reasons to believe that the gospel accounts about Jesus are sound. And if they are sound, then the salient details of the gospel accounts actually took place. And if they actually took place, that means Jesus claimed to be God, claimed to be the Messiah of the world. In fact, all of those multiple claims that he made, extravagant claims, the way, the truth, and the life, the resurrection and the life, the living water, the bread of life, the only door, the good shepherd, the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, all of these things, these are thick. The Bible is thick with these statements of Jesus, and they're central to his entire ministry. And then you have along with this the miracle accounts, you have his death, and you have his resurrection. Now, if all of those things actually happened and the historical record seems to indicate that they did, that seems to be the best explanation for the accounts we have, well, then Jesus is someone to contend with. We ought to listen to what he says. And Jesus thought the rest of the Old Testament was true. I mean, I could try to prove the Old Testament independently, but this is a line of argument that is certainly legitimate. If Jesus demonstrates beyond a reasonable doubt that he is who he claimed to be, God, based on the things that he did, then his words regarding a whole host of things have authority. I think the Bible is true. That is, I think the things that are claimed in there correspond to reality. The historical claims correspond to what actually happened, and the theological claims are reflective of things that are actually the case. And part of the evidence for the second is the evidence for the first. That is, I trust the theological claims because of the historical claims, and the historical claims are just not any old history. They are attesting miracles that Jesus performed, and so did the apostles. And so this puts their statements in a different light. Now, that may not be totally adequate for every single critic, but that's something. It's not nothing. I'm not just making it up. Dan Brown is making it up. I don't know what the other guy is doing. Anyway, let's see what Lewis has to say. Lewis, welcome to the show.
Hi, Greg.
Hi, Lewis.
Michael. Mm-hmm. Frequently you have calls concerning the issue of inspiration and the efficacy of biblical, or rather of...
Yeah, could you talk a little louder? You got some static there, and I need to hear you clearly there, Lewis.
Yeah, I'm calling in regards to the issue of divine inspiration.
Yes.
And in some of your writings online, you've written that God does not try to communicate in terms of his inspiration. He's never hindered by human limitations nor surprised by unforeseen contingencies.
Yeah, well, that's true. What I've said is God doesn't try, he does. When he intends to accomplish something, he fulfills his intention.
And also this issue of the original autographs, we don't have the autographs.
That's correct.
I want to go back to a time when we actually had one autograph.
Okay.
And this was the time when Moses went up to the mountain. He goes up to speak to God face-to-face for 40 days and 40 nights, a 40-day-night seminar with God. God gives him a written copy of the law,
right,
and explains to him the law for 40 days and 40 nights. He doesn't eat food nor drinks water.
Right.
He communes with God. But now, paradoxically, we read just a short time later, after giving him these laws, which included the law about the Sabbath, the prohibition.
Well, the Ten Commandments seem to be the detail there. We don't know all the other things that are happening up there because,
Right, that's true. I'm sure it's more expanded than the Ten Commandments, but it definitely included the Ten Commandments. And one of the commandments was not to work on the Sabbath, nor light a fire or suffer stoning.
Right.
And so in Numbers we read, now the congregation is wandering about and they come across a stranger who's gathering sticks on the Sabbath. They bring him before Moses because they do know the law because, as Deuteronomy says, God actually spoke to the people also.
Well, he did just a bit, and then the people told him, we can't stand hearing his voice. Moses, you talk to him. So they didn't get people didn't get all of the law from God. We just had to be careful about the details here.
That's good. Very good. Okay, so anyway, the people are confounded, but they recognize that they have to bring the guy to Moses.
That's right. He broke the law. It's a capital crime, so they have to stone him.
Right. So they go to Moses. They say, what should we do with this man? They tell him the facts of the case, and Moses doesn't know what to do. So Moses has to go into the tent of meeting, speaks to the Lord, and the Lord speaks to him and tells him that this man shall surely be put to death.
Uh-huh.
So my question is this, simply, that Moses is up there speaking 40 days and 40 nights directly with God. He receives the message directly. He has a written copy of the text.
Right.
And yet he is still unable to give an explicit determination of what the text means. And yet it seems rather paradoxical that if God, you know, went through this big effort and Moses did too, yet he still doesn't know what to do and he has to go back for another conference.
Okay, well let's just take your characterization of that account at face value. Let's just stipulate for the sake of discussion that you have reflected it accurately. Not that you would mislead me, but sometimes it's the details are missed sometimes in a careful reading, and I'm not going to go back right now to go read all of that text to find out what's going on.
Okay.
But let's just say that's the case. Well, it even so, it wouldn't imply necessarily that Moses didn't know what was required. However, he might have had some misgivings about in that circumstance enforcing it. Does this, under these circumstances, is it in fact a real violation of that particular law that God gave? And so, particularly since the punishment is so extreme and he's maybe uncertain on this issue, maybe he hadn't even confronted this circumstance since God had given the law, then he's going back for clarification. Are you sure you want me to do it the way you said, you know, a couple of months ago? So that might be one explanation. Frankly, I don't know what was in Moses' mind, and I'm not sure what this proves. It could, you know, even if Moses was confused and he wasn't certain, it certainly wouldn't prove that God didn't communicate clearly. I think the fault would be more likely on Moses' part, not on God's part. Human beings get things mixed up. They get confused about things, uncertain about things. And in this particular case, especially since Moses had direct access to God, he could go into the tent of meeting and get a clarification, which he did, and everything. Then he moves forward and does what God tells him to do. So, I'm not sure what exactly is meant to – what follows from the observation. If we take your observations at face value, what do you think – I'm not sure what you're trying to make of this, Lewis.
Well, I think that it raises a number of issues, a number of epistemological or hermeneutical issues.
It does seem odd. There's no question about that. Now, but there's a lot of odd things in the Scriptures because people are odd, you know. I mean, look at the apostles saw Jesus do all kinds of amazing things. I mean, they saw Jesus feed the 4,000, 5,000, then feed the 4,000. And then when Jesus says, beware of the bread of the Pharisees, they think, oh my gosh, we don't have any bread in the boat. Oh, we're going to starve. And he said, hey, didn't you learn anything from what you just saw? So we understand that human beings are silly. And even the apostles with Jesus there. So I wouldn't be surprised if Moses didn't get silly sometimes too and confuse things.
I think that of all the people in the Bible, he's one of the least silly.
Well, that's true. But he's not. He still does silly things. Yeah. I mean, there's no question about that. You know, he gets in trouble with God. He never goes into the promised land. So,
but this is unique for two different reasons. Because number one, you have a written copy of the text. In other words, there's not a gap between the original autograph and the latter day, the later generation that's pumped out on you.
Well, this isn't clear to me. When God, he writes the law in the stone, okay? Now, obviously, he can't write the whole book of Exodus and Leviticus in stone because Moses wouldn't be able to carry that down. It looks like the Ten Commandments were in stone, and certainly breaking the Sabbath was in the Ten Commandments. Those were tablets that were broken and then had to be restored. Those things were in the tablets, but they but not the rest of the law. And the punishments for breaking the Sabbath was another law. So it isn't necessarily the case that Moses had all of these things written down by God, which he offered to the people. Now, it might have been sometime later that he copied down the details. Frankly, I don't know that. Right. Even if he did have it all there, then still what he knows is he says, okay, here's what God said. Gee, I'm going to double check. That doesn't strike me as odd at all. Go ahead. I'll give you the last word, and then I have to go to break. Go ahead, Lewis.
I just feel like you're kind of patting yourself there a little
bit. I'm giving the text the benefit of the doubt, which is the standard thing you do with every text.
Right, but every version of the Ten Commandments contains a Sabbath law.
Of course.
The law is specific. It says you do X, you are stoned to death, and there are a number other of issues which have the same penalty.
Okay.
There's no question raised on there. Plus,
well, because there's not a
40-day and 40-night seminar with God face to face. I mean, it would seem like if God anticipates any kind of unforeseen occurrence, as you suggested here before, some unforeseen contingency, then God would have had the ability to straighten this issue out.
Of course.
Any kind of uncertainty in the mind of Moses.
Of course. There's all kinds of things he could have said that he might not have said. I mean, I'm just going to leave it at that, Lewis. This seems like a significant thing to you. It doesn't seem like a significant thing to me. It's a judgment call. I don't know what to say. I am giving him the benefit of the doubt, and because that's what you normally do with when you're being charitable with any text. If you wrote me a letter and something looked goofy, I would try to figure out, gee, maybe he meant this or whatever, and give you the benefit of the doubt too, instead of assuming a contradiction off the bat. Thanks for the call, though. Appreciate that. More to come. 1-800-227-5278, and in the 714 area code 714. I make that 754-4150. I'm Greg Kokel.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Want to make a difference for a Christianity worth thinking about? Stand to Reason can help you do just that. STR trains Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You will learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting STR Radio today. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2-REASON or send your gift to 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. Again, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. And thank you for listening.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org.
I'm raising a child in these devices, so easily enticed by darker means. When out of the wilderness of choice, I hear that one.
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason, and looking forward to talking to you on the show that turns your mind on, with you every Sunday, 3 until 5. Fresh in from Georgia. Boy, that was nice down there. I had a nice debate, some good training, and now I'm back with you guys. And the lines are pretty full, so let's go back to the calls. And Mike, welcome to Stand to Reason. Glad you called. Whoa, Mike.
Oh, hi, Greg.
Hi there. How are you?
Well, I am just fine. I have a couple questions for you.
Okay, we've got a lot of background noise there. I don't know if you can do anything about it, but...
Oh, well, yes, I can. I guess I can move out of the Starbucks area that I'm in and,
okay.
wander into the bookstore.
All right. What's on your mind?
And hopefully that will do the trick.
Okay, that's much better. Thank you.
Oh, good. Well, first of all, Greg, I noticed in your arguments for objective truth, both if we're talking in terms of truth itself, in terms of metaphysics, or in terms of ethics.
Right.
First of all, I want to say that I happen to like your arguments an awful lot. I appreciate that when a person says there is no truth, he's making that assertion with the implicit assumption that in fact there is truth.
Mm-hmm.
I've encountered people like that at USC all the time, and it always is a source of amusement for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I was just thinking about that, just to jump in for a quick second here, Mike. It wouldn't actually prove that there was truth. It would prove that his claim establishes there's truth, so it's self-refuting. I mean, we could say, well, okay, you're right, I'm self-refuting. I guess there is – I guess I can't say anything. But, it's strictly speaking, I mean, you're pretty much caught at that point, you know. I mean, if it's possible to make any claim about anything – there are going to be some claims that correspond. You know, to say that there is no truth is a claim that is meant to correspond with reality, and if it corresponds with reality, then that's true, and therefore, you're stuck. So there just seem to be a number of things that are necessarily true, like the laws of logic, or if I'm talking, my existence. So there's a foundational set of things we can know for certain, and that's a set of things that we can call truth.
Oh, definitely. Now, the first question I had in my mind is that the kind of arguments that you use very much resemble those that Nathaniel Brandon used. In fact, they're almost word for word, those of Brandon in the Nathaniel Brandon Institute lectures of maybe 40 years ago or so. He lectured about Ayn Rand's philosophy, objectivism, which, if we're talking about basic truth, argues that truth and ethics are both objective.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just kind of wondering, are you familiar with that?
I'm not familiar with that gentleman. I just know the name Ayn Rand and that she has a view of objectivism called enlightened and morality called enlightened self-interest. I know she wrote Atlas Shrugged and another book, but I really don't know anything about her philosophy. All that I'm aware of is that she does try – I think she tries to ground morality in a way that does not entail God, and from what I understand, I don't think it's possible to do that. And I've heard—I can't remember the details of it, but I recall that I think she characterizes morality in a way that seems. If I remember my responses at the time, I heard more detail about it. She characterizes morality in a way that didn't seem to me to capture our main intuitions about what morality was. I mean, enlightened self-interest, that was morality. But, of course, self-interest itself, taken one way at least, would be considered immoral, selfishness. So how can selfishness be immoral but self-interest be the ground of morality? Anyway, it just raises some questions, but that's nothing like a critique because I don't know enough about her to critique her. But I didn't get my information from there. I'm just more of a – kind of a simple objectivist there. It seems obvious in virtue of some of our intuitions, moral intuitions, for example, that moral truths exist in the objective sense. So I'm an objectivist in the sense that I mean that the claims that I'm making are true with response to the object itself and not just with respect to the subject that is believing the truth, whether the subject is an individual or a group.
Oh, I completely agree with you, and I love the way that you think about such things. Actually, there are a number of issues, but the first issue or the main issue in my mind is why, Greg, do you personally believe in God?
Well, I think I believe in God because I think He's the best explanation for the way the world is, and that entails a whole lot of things. But that's just a one sentence kind of expression. Everything didn't come from nothing. Life
True.
Didn't come from non-life. Consciousness didn't come from.
That's an unfair assumption. But go ahead.
Wait, wait. Well, we have no reason. All of our experience is that life comes from life, okay? All right? And life is a highly complex, specified and complex thing, which has all the earmarks of intelligence. And therefore, if life wasn't at one point in time in the Earth history and it was at another point, I have a choice. Life came from non-life, abiogenesis, or life came from an intelligent creator. I have no evidence whatsoever that life could possibly come from non-life, and I have plenty of evidence that the life that we see is it has the marks of intelligent design, and so therefore I'm justified in believing that an intelligent designer designed life. And by the same, you could also say we don't know that everything came from nothing, didn't come from nothing. I'm using
No. That's if you hold with Aristotle, if a thing existed, it existence always comes from existence. In order to say that at one time it came from nothing, you would have to say that at one point there was nothing, which is not a superior type of thing, but the absence of a thing.
Right. I understand entirely. I'm with you. I agree, and I don't think it's because Aristotle said it. I think it's because it's a profound, accurate intuition that anybody, as they reflect on it for a moment, realizes that nothing comes from nothing. Since the universe came into being, I presume something caused it to come into being. Since life...
Not so. Again, unwarranted assumption. As soon as you say that something caused it to come into being, you are saying that at one time there was nothing, and then there was something.
No, not at all. I said something caused it to come into being. I'm presuming only that the universe came into being, that there was a time when it did not exist.
But that is your unwarranted assumption.
Well, okay, it isn't an unwarranted assumption because I have arguments to demonstrate that that's the case. Big Bang cosmology, the second law of thermodynamics, the impossibility of actual infinites by adding one to another. There's a number of lines of evidence.
All of our actual experience, Greg, is that if there was a something, then that something came from something else. That there was never a nothing from which there came a something.
Yes.
Now,
right.
if you say that God was the one who created the universe, you're saying that God did exist, that God was a something.
That's right.
A thing in himself, and presumably out of that thing which was him came the earth.
No problem there at all.
At some point later on.
By the way, just to jump in, you've charged me twice with unwarranted assumptions, and both
right.
times those charges were false.
Not true.
But I wasn't, and I gave you the reasons why my assumptions were warranted, but I couldn't develop all of those reasons because we don't have time to go into all of the argumentation here. But the fact is, I believe in God for particular kinds of reasons, some of which I offered to you, and you've identified some of them because something can't come from nothing. And all of the evidence that we have, both from philosophy and from science, is that the universe came into being, into existence at some point, and therefore it must have been caused by something else that was existing at that time. And that's pretty straightforward application of Aristotelian thinking.
Not at all. In order to make that kind of statement in reason, you would have had to have been there.
This is false. This is just false. I don't even have to be anywhere to know that if a bomb if a bomb goes off in Asia somewhere, that something caused that. I don't have to be there to watch it blow up. This is a radical empiricism.
No, it's true. It's true. But in the
you just gave me the
floating in Asia. You still have evidence in reality that there was the bomb. You have the photograph.
No, I don't even have to have the photograph. All I got to know is that it took place. If there's a crater that was caused.
Well, how do you know that it took place? If we're not talking. I don't want to be sarcastic. I felt like it. Gosh darn it, I'm going to restrain myself.
No, but you know, what you're doing is you're moving forward on a radical empiricistic basis that you can't know something unless you see it or somebody gave you a photograph of it or something. But the fact is you can know a lot of things just by inference as the best explanation for an effect. Here's a set of effects, and I can conclude. I walk into the studio, and there's a cake sitting on the table. Frosting, and it has my name. It says happy birthday. Now, it's not my birthday today, but what can I possibly infer from that? Would it be fair to say that I can infer justifiably that somebody baked the cake, that somebody brought it in and set it here? I didn't see that happen. I can look at the effect, and I can infer the causes that are necessary for that.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Great.
And the reasoning that you give is precisely the best reasoning that there is no God, because there's all the world of difference between a person who goes on the desert, and he's looking on the desert, and he finds a stick of chewing gum with the words Wrigley's on it, and then lo and behold, he knows that man has been there.
Well, he knows
but just looking at the natural beauty of the desert, all he concludes is that no one has been there, including a god.
No, until he looks at the cells of the cactus sitting next to him, or the rattlesnake that's about to bite him on the butt, and he sees a whole library of information written there in the DNA, then he is justified that something outside of nature has written this information into nature, into the DNA code. I'm glad to use Wrigley's as an example, because one word is enough to convince you that a man or an intelligent designer is involved when you have billions of lines of code in the DNA molecule and you're still unwilling to admit that some intelligent designer did that. It's a good way to end the show. I should say end the hour. The show's not over. We've got another hour ahead of us. I'm Greg Kokel. Give us a call. We'll talk about the critical issues of life right here on Stand to Reason.
Oh, this isn't going to be about Jesus, is it?
Yeah, we'll try to avoid the J word there. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason, hour number two here. Clear thinking Christianity, ladies and gentlemen. Get the fat out of your thinking and trim down to fight and weight every weekend here on Stand to Reason. Open lines 1-800-227-5278. Now's your chance. I started out last hour after I got finished with my fish story, talking about how in our culture we have adopted certain ways of thinking that we... I don't know if we accept them without thinking entirely, but we own them somewhat reflexively and not reflectively. We don't think very deeply about it. And I use an example of the debate and a problem that my debate opponent, last Thursday night in Georgia, at Georgia, Columbia State University. A corner he got himself in because he wasn't careful thinking about what he was saying. He was just reacting. Do you believe in truth? No, there is no truth. Well, why is he debating if he doesn't believe in truth? The similar thing happened to me this morning as I was flying in from Georgia, and I had a woman that was sitting next to me, and it was a very pleasant woman who took an interest in what I was reading. I was reading a book on The Philosophy of Science by Losey, and she asked if it was good, and I said, well, actually, it's not that. It's too technical for the most part to be that interesting to me, but there are some things that were helpful. And this is going to tie in a bit to the call I just had a few moments ago with Mike, who, as we talked for a little bit while, started with some principles that I thought were useful to work with and then seemed to deny some of those principles and then fell back into a knee-jerk empiricism. I can't draw any conclusions about the beginning of the universe because I wasn't there to watch it. I mean, this is just a stunning remark to hear from a thinking person. By the way, a lot of Christians say the same thing. They say, well, nobody was there to see the creation event, so we can't know it. It's all faith. Christians have their faith, evolutionists have their faith. Ladies and gentlemen, that statement reflects that we have bought empiricism as a way of looking at the world. Empiricism is the idea that you can't know it unless you see it, taste it, smell it, hear it, or touch it. You can only know the things from your five senses, and other than that, you can't know anything. It's just all a leap of faith. That's not a Christian way of looking at the world, friends. We buy that, and it's reflected in this statement, and the gentleman, Mike, just made the same statement himself. And the ironic thing is I had made an argument that you can know things from the effects and inferring the cause necessary for the effect. And he used an example of a Wrigley gum wrapper in the desert. I guess I could ask him, listen, Did you see any human being drop that Wrigley gum wrapper? Did you watch them print it? How did you know that was an artifact then and an example of intelligence when you didn't see it? I mean, the empiricism works against him too. His empiricism can't tell him where that came from. It can't even tell him that it's a Wrigley gum wrapper. All it can tell him is it's a thing that looks that way. Well, that's the knee-jerk reaction without thinking about the nature of what you're saying. And so on the airplane, the woman asked me about the book, and I was talking a little bit about Hume because I was on that point. I said, well, this is interesting. Here's David Hume, who says you can't know anything unless you know it through the five senses, empiricism. And she said, well, that's right. And I said, well, I don't think so. I mean, I was friendly and everything, but I began to ask her some questions. And I said, well, you couldn't even know your own thoughts that way because you don't know your thoughts through hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, or what did I leave out? Seeing. You don't know your own thoughts, right? Well, I think, yeah. And it's funny because when I said that, I challenged her empiricism with a clear case counterexample that related to her own mental life. She balked. It's like she wasn't sure. I said, wait a minute, you know what you're thinking, don't you? Well, yeah. I said, look, do they weigh anything? If you have a really big thought, is it take up more space in your brain? Because she made a reference to your thoughts being in your brain. And this is what scientists say. Your thoughts are in your brain. I said, well, if you had a bigger thought, would it weigh more? No. Would it take up more space? No. Is it longer? No, I guess not. But then it's not physical, is it? But the scientists say, dot, dot, dot. I mean, I couldn't believe my ears. Here's a woman, and she knows better, obviously. But there was this knee-jerk reaction. Well, the scientists say it's physical. I said, you have better access to your own thoughts than the scientist does. You just reflect on your own thoughts for a moment. You tell me about your own thoughts. Don't you see? In reflection on the thing that you're beholding right now, the interior life of your mind, that these things are not physical things. Excuse me. Do you see that? Okay, I guess so. She was not certain. And then she said, oh, by the way, did you see the latest Reader's Digest from a couple of months ago, actually? He had a great article in there about somebody who left their body. And this was the only case that they've proven where the woman was really dead and she left her body. I said, well, actually, I have some friends who've written quite a bit on that, and there's a number of cases where this is the case. But of course, well, what she did is she said that she had this near-death experience, this NDE, and of course her body was dead. The woman had all her blood drained out of her body. I don't know what was going on, some weird thing. And then they pumped it back in, and they pumped her back up, and they got her going again, and they revived her, and she's alive again. But she had this out-of-body experience. But then she said, but they couldn't prove it. Why? Because there's no physical evidence. You can't prove that kind of thing because there's no physical evidence. Notice the implicit empiricism there. And I said, well, sure you can prove that kind of thing. She said, how? I said, it's very easy. If a person has an out-of-body experience and that person goes to some other location and witnesses a detailed event that just happens at the very time their body is under sedation, and then when they return to their body and awaken on the table, give an account of that, and someone can check it out and see that it actually happened, that would be proof. That would be very powerful evidence that she was actually there. In other words, this person who left their body and had this out-of-body experience. And she said, but there's no physical evidence. I said, there doesn't have to be any physical evidence. There's the testimony of what she saw that can be compared to what actually happened, that would be evidence that she did leave her body. And the woman said, but it's just her word against theirs. Now, I almost fell out of my seat. And I guess what I was stunned about the most, and I don't think, obviously, this is new material for this woman to think about these things in this way, to talk about these things, and she maybe was caught by surprise, and she wasn't maybe thinking clearly or whatever. But the point I'm making, ladies and gentlemen, is I think I made a good case for the way in which one can verify a bona fide, veridical, out-of-body experience. And in fact, those NDEs, near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, have been verified in that way. And that's why we can have a high degree of confidence that they really happen. And if that happens, then the person is away from their body, or their body's being operated on. The person is not the body. Physicalism is false. Dualism of some sort is demonstrated to be so. That seems to be obvious to me. Now, she may not be used to all of the jargon and everything, but I was trying to communicate it in language that I think the average person could understand. And if you just see the concept as I described it, you'd see the legitimacy of that kind of argument. But it was this knee-jerk empiricism that she continued to fall back on. It was like, but the scientists say, but there's no physical evidence, but it's just her word against theirs. I couldn't believe it. Anyway, well, this is one of the things we're up against. People are not reflecting, they're reacting. Back to the phones. And Carl, welcome to Stand to Reason. Hi.
Hello?
Hello, Carl. You're on.
Oh, Greg, thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome, Carl. Glad you called.
I'm a Christian. I'm doing some in-depth studies. Who is Jesus?
Uh-huh.
And I heard you say, I think I heard you say that Jesus is God.
Yes.
And I've heard people say God the Father and God the Son.
Correct.
I haven't in my studies found anywhere where it refers to God the Son. So I have some scriptures here, if I may read them. Jesus is asking the disciples who men say he is, and then he says, who do you say I am?
Mm-hmm.
And Simon Peter, this is in Matthew 16,
right.
16, Simon Peter answered and said, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. He didn't say, you are God the Son.
That's correct. Well, he says the Son of God, okay, and then the question is it fair to call the Son of God, God the Son? Because it seems like he's not calling him God, he's calling him the Son,
right.
Not God. Okay, I got you there. Do you want me to respond to that?
Well, I'd like to go on here and then...
Well, okay, you can't go on too far, but give me another instance or two and then I'll give you...
Jesus answers Peter and says, you wouldn't know this if my Father hadn't told you.
Correct.
Something of that nature.
Yes.
Then I'm having a hard time finding that Jesus is fully God. I've heard someone say Jesus is fully God. Then there's another one, of course...
You're looking for a statement that says Jesus is fully God. Is that what you're looking for in the Gospels or in the Scriptures?
Well, I'm not sure how to answer that. But
well, I mean, would you be satisfied with a statement in other passages that were, say, in the epistles in the New Testament, as opposed to in the Gospels where Jesus is saying himself?
Well,
what are you looking for?
Is that Jesus has a God? Says, my God, my God.
I understand that. I understand that.
And then the Father, actually, to me, it reads this way in Hebrews 1, chapter 1, verse 9, and there's quite a bit here to go through. But
well, you can't go through a whole bunch of it. Just give me the sense of it.
That's what I mean. It says, therefore God, I think it's the Father talking to Jesus.
Yes.
It says, therefore God, your God. In other words, God the Father is telling Jesus that Jesus is God.
Okay, but he's addressing who? He's addressing Jesus as what? What's the word he's using to describe Jesus?
Well, he said...
He's using the word God.
Yes, God, your God.
Okay, so now you got two gods.
Well, the Father says he's the God of Jesus.
That's right, but he also calls the Son God.
Yes, yeah, so Jesus is God, but he's not fully God like the Father is.
Well, no, it doesn't say he's not fully God. It does say that there's something going on there that we have to take note of. It doesn't say that he's fully God. If you look to the first couple of verses there in the book of Hebrews, it says he is the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature. Exact representation of his nature, verse 3, chapter 1, verse 3 there in Hebrews, all right? So that gives you a little bit more detail. Verse 8 of chapter 1, but of the Son, he says, thy throne, O God, is forever and ever. Pardon me?
I'm looking at it.
Okay, but of the Son, he says, thy throne, O God, is forever and ever. In other words, the Son is God. There's the statement right there in verse 8. The statement also in verse 3, I mentioned that the writer of Hebrews identifies the Son as being the exact representation of the Father, of God's nature, okay?
Image of his glory, or a person, rather.
He is the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature, and upholds all things by the word of his power. So now you have, regarding the Son, he's called the exact representation of God's nature, and that it is the Son that has the divine attribute of holding all things upholding all things by the word of his power. Now, so what you're identifying here, Carl, is that there isn't some odd things going on. The Bible says that there is one God, no question about that. But Jesus talks about having a God, and that seems to be clear. But then we have these other statements. It says here in verse 8 of Hebrews, and you brought this passage up, the Son is called God.
Right.
In there, we see in Hebrews that the Son is the exact representation of God's nature. Now, nothing else is like God but God himself, but the Son is called the exact representation of his nature. We see Peter calling Jesus the Son of God. Now, we know that to us seems, well, that's just the Son of God, not God the Son. However, to claim to be the Son of God is to claim equality with God. How do we know that? Because the people responded that way. They understood in the context of their culture, this is what the phrase meant. If you say that you're the Son of God, let's see, do you have any children?
No. Carl?
Okay, well, if you had a son, Carl, what kind of being would he be? What kind of being?
A human being, I guess.
He would be a human being. He would have the same nature as you, right?
Right.
If God has a son, if God is divine and has a son, what kind of being would the son be? A divine being, right? That's exactly right. So for God to have a son, the son would be divine just like the father is. And in the case of this son, there is only one God. And so when God has a son, the divine being is God himself. This is why the Jews sought to kill Jesus, is because he claimed to be God. Using the language of the time, the Son of God was a claim to divinity. If you go to Mark chapter 2, you see Jesus claiming to forgive sins. The people there say, who can forgive sins but God alone? And he said, in order that you'll know that I have the authority to forgive sins, here, stand up and walk to the paralytic, and he did. And so there Jesus demonstrated that, pardon me, he was God by able to forgive sins by doing this miraculous healing.
But Jesus said, I have no power except that what is given to me.
Yes, okay, so now you've got all of these odd statements. Now, how do you make sense of all of these odd statements?
That's what I'm trying to
do. Yes, exactly. No, and I'm sympathetic.
One more?
No, we don't have to do any more. We don't have time for any more because we got plenty of a mess right here, all right?
Okay.
How do we fix this? How is it that there's one God, that there's God the Father, and then God has a son in Jesus who's a man, and that man has a God, and that man is God? I mean, how do you make sense of this? There's only one way to make sense of this, Carl, and that is the doctrine of the Trinity. And the doctrine of the Trinity says that God has three persons, the Father, Son, and the Spirit, though there is one God. And the second person became a man, and this man was both God and man. So Jesus, who is God and who is a man at the same time, he has two natures, sometimes he makes reference to his human nature. Sometimes he's speaking with regards to his divine nature. I mean, when it says that Jesus walked down the road to Emmaus, I mean, that's not, you know, God doesn't have a body. His body's not walking. That's Jesus' physical body, which is a human body, that is being referred to there. But when Jesus says, before Abraham was, I am, well, he's not referring to his physical body because he's only 33 years old. In fact, that's what the Jews said to him there in John 8. Gee, you're not even 30 years old or 30. And you know Abraham. But that's because in his divine nature, he was God. And they picked up stones to throw him because he used the name of God there when he said the I am. So when Jesus is saying, I have a God, he is referring to his physical body that was created by God. His physical human nature has a God, but his divine nature is God. That's the only way to make sense of all of these different verses, and this is why we have the doctrine of the Trinity. I've done a teaching, and you're welcome to contact Stand to Reason for this. You might enjoy it, where I deal with this particular issue in depth. The teaching is called The Trinity, A Solution, Not a Problem. The Trinity, A Solution, Not a Problem. And this is the point I'm making. If you don't have the Trinity, you got all kinds of problems. Once you have the Trinity, you solve these textual problems, every one of them that you're bringing up. And I go into a lot of detail in that tape, and it includes the notes. I think the notes go with it. So if you got the tape, you'd have all the notes with all the references and everything, and it'll help make more sense out of this for you.
I'm writing a treatise on the Trinity, too.
You are writing one?
Yes.
Well, good. Please, are you studying for it? Are you working? What are your sources that you're using?
Well, I'm using the Scripture, the King James, New King James.
Yeah, you're going to need...
Also a Greek Bible, Hebrew Greek Bible.
Yeah, you also should get some good commentaries to help you explain some of this. And I would say get my book. Now, not my book, but the tape. It doesn't mean you got to believe everything I say, but it does mean that you would do best to draw from the hard work of others and weigh that in light of your own research. All right, I'm not saying don't do your own research, but don't just let your research be the only source of information. That is a guaranteed ticket to get you in big trouble. Because other people, frankly, have more knowledge and background and whatever insight than you and either you or I have, and it makes sense to draw from their insight. All right?
Well, thank you very much, Greg.
Okay, Carl, it's nice talking to you. I appreciate the call, and it's a tough issue, and I think that tape will help you in your own studies. I'm glad you're studying it, by the way. It's important. Time for break. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. Don't go away.
Did you know that the old car, truck, boat, or RV that is gathering dust in your garage can actually change the lives of Christians around the world? By donating your used vehicle to Stand to Reason, you can help develop training materials that will build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. Don't worry if it won't start. We'll tow it away at no charge and help you with all the paperwork. And when we leave, you'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car. Transform your old vehicle into practical training for Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
Have you ever wished you could articulate your faith and beliefs more clearly? Do you feel confident when talking with friends and coworkers about sensitive subjects like abortion and homosexuality? Call today to request the latest issue of Solid Ground, our bi-monthly newsletter. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you represent your faith, even when discussing the most timely and heated of subjects like evolution, cloning, and stem cell research. Now you can avoid feeling uneasy or embarrassed when you want to stand up as a Christian ambassador. Simply pick up the phone and call Stand to Reason today. Don't get caught by surprise. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will teach you how to represent your faith as an ambassador of Christ in a concise and attractive manner. Contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit us on the web at www.str.org. Just request our newsletter called Solid Ground. We'll send it to you free when you call 1-800-2-REASON.
All the better to get the facts. I just want to get the facts, ma'am. All the better to serve you with.
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason, and with you every weekend for freewheeling open discussion of contemporary ethical issues, defense of classical Christianity, and also defense of classical Christian values. And let's see, lines are pretty bogged up, so let's go back to them and talk with Frank here. Frank, welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing, Greg?
Fine.
I'm writing a research paper concerning same-sex marriage, and I'm coming up with a few problems. The first one, I guess, is seems like the whole crux of the argument concerning if you're going to argue that it should not be legal for same-sex marriage, which is something I'm trying to write on, is that it doesn't seem that there's any legal document anywhere besides that of certain, you know, judges' opinions that they've written, that there actually is stated in any legal document what the express purpose of marriage is.
Right.
And
I mean, that may be the case. I don't know. But that to me is not even relevant.
Well, I mean, the problem with that is that if there's no express purpose, and you want to argue that the, you know, the purpose of marriage is that of procreation and creation of a family, then you have the response that, for instance,
No, I'm still here. Go ahead.
The Massachusetts State Supreme Court countered that by saying, well, all you've done when you say that the purpose of marriage is procreation is taken the one difference between that of a heterosexual and a same-sex couple and made that the central issue.
Well, it is the central issue. It is. And see, here's the deal. And let me sketch something out for you, and then I've done a lot of work on this in the last couple of months, and let me see if I can offer you a way of looking at this. I'm trying to think of where the best starting point is, because I think sometimes a lot of there's a lot more heat than light that's shed on these kinds of debates, because we get lost in kind of a crossfire of civil rights claims, okay, claims and counterclaims and everything, okay. How do we know what marriage is? Okay, well, we have to look at it to define it. And in fact, we're not even defining it, we're describing it. The reason that there is not a legitimate civil rights claim, the basis of this objection with marriage is heterosexuals can get married, but homosexuals can't get married. The answer to that is, yes, homosexuals can get married. That is, they can do all the things that married people do. Nobody's stopping them. The one thing that they can't have is they don't get the privileges of heterosexual couples getting married. But are you with me?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Okay, but the question is, why is it that heterosexual couples get certain privileges that homosexual couples don't? And the answer is because they're different. There is a fundamental difference between heterosexual couples and homosexual couples on the issue of these kinds of recognition and benefits. But you have to answer the question, what is marriage? From the very beginning of time, marriage has always entailed males and females, all right? In any characterization, any construal of marriage that you ever have, it's entailed males and females, correct?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, up until now. And why is that? Cultures have favored – the word marriage is a way of the culture favoring a particular relationship. Okay, why has culture favored that relationship? Why has culture given special privileges to a male and female union? There's only one reason, and that reason is because they produce the next generation. If males and females are in relationships that do not potentially produce the next generation, the government does not care what happens.
Okay, here's one of the questions that what they could reply to that is, okay, obviously males and females are the only person, seemingly anyway, that could provide the next generation. Actually, not seemingly, definitely. They're the only ones that can provide the next generation.
That's right, and that's
We're living in an age now where we have enough technology where women, you know, women couples don't even need a man physically present or whatever to have a baby through artificial insemination,
okay,
or whatever.
Okay,
and technically, I'm with you.
I got you. Okay, I'm not sure. I understand why people raise this, but when I think about the nature of the objection, I don't understand the objection. The reason that government cultures have always favored a male-female relationship is because males and females produce the next generation. All right, fine.
All right.
Now, just because you can produce a kid in a test tube doesn't mean that males and females aren't still producing the next generation. They are. The idea is to protect children. So you have inheritance rights that protect children. You have special insurance things that protect children. You have tax benefits that protect families. I mean, all of these things are protecting children. All the special privileges that married couples get are for the purpose of protecting the children. Now, it may turn out that some individual married couples don't choose to have the children that the relationship is favored before, that doesn't change the fact that the government favors the relationship for the next generation. Just because some people can produce a baby, very few, under very odd circumstances, doesn't mean that mothers and fathers produce children. The government protects the children. If there's not children involved, there's no reason to protect that relationship. And this is why the government doesn't favor any other relationship. Two fraternity brothers hanging out together, spinsters that live together, Tom, Dick, and Harry, who happen to be in the same apartment building, they don't get any special privileges from the government because there's no reason to. So when homosexual partners get married, quote unquote, that is, they set up housekeeping and they walk down the aisle, they say I do, and they can all do this. They can have a wedding of sorts. They can walk down the aisle. They can say, I do. They can pledge their troth till death do them part. They can set up housekeeping. They can sleep together. They can share property. They can do all those things. But it's not a marriage. Why not? Because marriage is the special relationship that government favors that produces children, specifically because it produces children. And if it doesn't produce children, the government doesn't care. This is the point I'm making. The government has no business regulating private relationships. There's no interest in the culture to regulate private relationships. And so when the Massachusetts Supreme Court says, oh, you're making marriage on this one thing, having children, that's the one way they differ. That's exactly right. They got something right for a change. They figured out that marriage is about children. And this is true in every single culture from the beginning of time. And I don't care if you believe in Adam and Eve or evolution, it's always been the same thing. Family starts first, and then it builds a culture. Families build cultures.
Okay, here's a question I have then. I obviously agree with what you're saying, but I'm trying to figure out how to respond, because functionally, I mean, the government has seen it, right? Obviously, the minority of the cases, but in those minority of the cases, a heterosexual couple obviously cannot have a baby. They go, they have artificial insemination,
fine,
whatever medical work done.
It's still that related.
They have a child, and they get full benefits from the government.
Of course.
Now, completely functionally, a homosexual couple can, female couple obviously, could do the exact same thing, and in the eyes of the law, why should that be any different than the other one? Obviously,
oh, okay. Well,
you're talking about, yeah, the main reason for marriage is that they produce.
Not the main reason.
Families. Excuse me?
It's not the main reason, Frank. It's the only reason. It is the only reason that government favors this relationship, because it builds the next generation. That's it. That's the only reason. Marriage is not a free ticket to group insurance rates. That's not the point. You have group insurance in a family because dad's working to support mom who's having kids. Mom and the kids aren't working. Dad is, and dad gets the insurance for the family, so everybody's protected. That's the point there. It isn't, you know.
It couldn't functionally, the homosexual couple, though, be exact in every way, except for there's not a heterosexual. If they have,
yes,
know, medically, they have a procedure done to have children.
I agree.
One's at home having the kids, the other one's out working.
Yes.
Functionally, it's the exact same thing, isn't it?
It is the exact same thing, except for...
I'm just... This is an argument that's raised that,
Frank,
I'm having a hard time, you know, legally coming, you know, with the...
Frank, listen to me. Frank, you're talking too much. I got answers for you, all right? I know you agree with me, all right? And so I'm just zeroing in. You say it's the exact same thing, except for the one thing that there are that there's no heterosexual relationship. Okay, great. What this then would argue for is that only in the occasion that homosexuals have children through artificial means, then they could be married and get the benefits of family to protect the children. Okay? That would follow. Not that homosexual relationships across the board should
Correct.
Be sanctified, because they don't have children. This is the exception rather than the rule. In the case of heterosexuals, it's the rule rather than the exception. But then that raises another problem. So I'm with you so far, so I'm granting, okay, you got it there, but now I got another argument. The very point that you made that was the distinctive difference in the case of homosexuals, that everything's the same except for they're both the same sex, is precisely the reason that they should not be allowed to have children. There's a reason in the natural order why males and females make kids. It's because kids need mothers and fathers, not two dads, not two moms, but mothers and fathers. Once you legitimize same-sex unions, you are saying it'll be impossible to deny adoption to same-sex couples, which is denied in some states, not here in this state, but in the state of Florida, for example, it's denied, and I think should be denied everywhere. And by the way, to show that I'm consistent, I think it should be adoption should be denied single people. Children need a mother and a father, not just two warm, loving bodies. They need
and
a mom and a dad.
I realize that. I know that, obviously you could argue the fact that, to the same sex, parents aren't the same as a mother and a father. But in my instance, with where I'm writing a paper about this, I can't obviously go off on a tangent and start arguing then against same-sex adoption. My problem is that if they have same-sex adoption already, then how is that different from the heterosexual couple with the baby already?
You're
not already disproving the other?
I understand. Okay. Well, the problem is when you raise an argument against something, then people are going to use counter-arguments, give you counter-examples, and then you have to have counter-arguments for the counter-arguments. So you can't avoid that kind of thing. You can't cover all the bases. It isn't like you can give an argument where they can't raise this counter-argument, because our argument just is that marriage by description, not definition. This is important. We don't just define marriage any way we want. Marriage already is. It's a relationship between a man and a woman that begins a family, and families entail children by natural order. And governments have an interest in protecting those families that create children and build the next generation. And so when back to the point that you just made, I lost my train of thought there for a moment. Back to the point that you're struggling with right now. Well, you make this argument that that marriage is for heterosexuals. Then they're going to because of family, and they're going to say, well, they can adopt. And that's when I say they shouldn't be adopting for the same reason. Children need a mother and a father as a parent, not just two of the same sex. And the big difference here, I think, I just cited this, is that in the case of homosexuals, it is the rare circumstance when homosexual partners want to adopt. It is the exception, not the rule. The reason it's the exception that homosexuals have a family is because they can't have a family naturally. In the case of heterosexuals, it is the rule, not the exception, that they have families. And therefore, given that it's the rule in the case of heterosexuals that they have families, children, and it's the rule in the case of homosexuals that they do not have children, then heterosexuals, as the rule, should get the protection of the government of being married, and homosexuals should not get that protection. And for the rare cases where they say, well, we can make it so, artificially so, that we qualify for the same concern that you're making, I'm saying you shouldn't be making it artificially so, because that disservices the child. That's basically saying that there is no difference between a mother and a father, that children don't need mothers and fathers. Children don't have a right to a mother and father. And in fact, what's going on here, and this is an underlying thing, if you affirm, and you might even argue this way, if you affirm same-sex marriage, if our culture does, our culture is saying as a matter of law, there is no difference between a man and a woman. That in child rearing and in sex, they are interchangeable. Men can have sex with women. Men can have sex with men. They're interchangeable. Children can have a mother and a father, or two mothers or two fathers. The sex is irrelevant. They're interchangeable. Now, do we want to say that as a culture that marriage is nothing in particular? We can redefine it the way we want and include homosexuals if we want. And if we do that, then we've got to – why not include all kinds of other things? Rub-a-dub-dub, 3 men in a tub and a potted plant. Why not? If it's just a matter of redefining it. If we're not going with the natural definition, the way it's been for thousands of years, then we can redefine it any way we want. And if we redefine it any way we want, we can do anything we want with it. So that's down the line. Secondly, we would be saying that there is no difference between a mother and a father, that there is no actual definition of marriage, that family is nothing in particular. It's anything we want it to make it. And children don't have a right to mothers and fathers. This is saying a mouthful when we promote same-sex marriage. All in favor of what? What do we get for this? What do we get out of it? Homosexuals don't get any liberty, and I promise you, they don't care about the insurance rates, because they already got insurance. For goodness' sake, they're both working; they got insurance. They care about public approval. All of this stuff that they're going after, they're getting. All of this destructiveness that comes to the nature of family and the special protection of children. All of this robbing children of mothers and fathers and declaring that males and females are interchangeable and exactly the same, all of this for what? To get social approval for homosexuality. That's it.
Okay. Could you also argue that the state has an interest in providing benefits, even if you could do all the same things in a homosexual marriage to produce a child, family, the next generation, et cetera, because heterosexuals, that way of producing a family and having that type of family has proven itself, you know, worthy and well of raising children throughout the centuries, whereas this is a very new thing that's happening now that we're allowing this.
Frank,
and the studies are very much in its infancy, and because of that, the government doesn't know whether or not this is good for kids, good for the next generation, therefore not worthy of putting its
approval. I get the point. I wouldn't go that way because I think that's weak. That's saying this is dangerous. We haven't been there before. We shouldn't go there in the future because we don't know what will happen. I think we've got a lot better case the way I outlined it. Let me recommend to you our new Solid Ground that just came out this week. If you receive Solid Ground, it's on same-sex marriage, and you can get it on our website at str.org, okay? Go there, get it, read it, and there's a lot of stuff that will be useful for you in your paper, and I hope you do well. Thanks for calling, and I got to run to break. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Want to make a difference for a Christianity worth thinking about? Stand to Reason can help you do just that. STR trains Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You will learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting STR Radio today. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2-REASON or send your gift to 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. Again, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. And thank you for listening.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org.
Are you sure it's legal?
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason, and I want to underscore that was kind of a tumultuous conversation with Frank. I mean, he was fine, but we were just going back and forth, and I was firing out a lot of things in a short time, and I was under the clock here. Please go to our website, str.org, and download Same-Sex Marriage Challenges and Responses. This is a piece I wrote recently. I've done a lot of thinking about this, and I think you'll find some very, very useful things there, ladies and gentlemen. I promise you, this issue is all about homosexuality getting approval in the culture, and it comes at a tremendous price. There are no new liberties that homosexuals get by getting married. What they get is respect, or at least they think they do, and it's forcing it on us, and basically the consequence is the culture has got to say marriage is nothing in particular. Mothers and fathers are nothing in particular. The sexes are interchangeable. And I think that's going to have devastating consequences. All right, let's go back to the phones. Tom, thanks for waiting.
Hello.
Hello, Tom. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks.
Sure.
I'm really grateful for your ministry. And
thank you.
Just wanted to thank you for making your shows available for download, too, because I've been putting them in my iPod.
And the MP3. I just bought an iPod, I bought a new computer, and it came with it, but it hasn't been delivered yet, so I'm looking forward to downloading some of the MP3 stuff myself.
It's great. You can take download the whole Bible, or loaded in. And
yeah, it's amazing how much stuff you can get on there.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's on your mind, Tom?
Well, a couple weeks ago you had a caller ask about how seriously pro-lifers take abortion if they wouldn't want to punish the mother as a murderer, just like any other murderer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you talked about Dennis's Prager had brought that up.
Mm-hmm.
And the explanation you gave was pretty nuanced and difficult. I still need to dive into it a little more completely. But I was wondering how you believe or how this logic might unravel if you were to say, yes, I'm guilty of that to some degree, because I really did. I actually did feel kind of like, yeah, why wouldn't I?
Okay, wait, help me out here. I don't recall the call you're referring to, and you don't have to rerun the entire call, but what specifically is the view that I expressed that you want to question about?
Well, the caller had said, well, do pro-lifers really take abortion seriously? I mean,
they really think it's murder.
Yeah, if they wouldn't be willing to punish, say, the mother or the doctor as a murderer like any other murder.
Uh-huh.
Like, if they wouldn't be willing to, say, have them stand for the death penalty.
Right, and my view is, yeah, and I think, I don't remember the call specifically, but I know what I think about that, and I actually have a piece on our website in a place called Town Square,
okay,
in which I respond to that issue about abortion and how do we punish the people. And I think that the question of – there are two questions here. One is the morality or moral propriety of the action itself, abortion.
Uh-huh.
And the second question is, and what exactly is abortion? What does it do? And the second question is, how do we deal with it as a culture? If it is an egregious crime, what kind of punishments should be placed upon that? Okay. And they're independent of each other. Okay. Now it's coming back. Maybe I can recall part of it. Maybe let's just say, for example, that pro-lifers didn't campaign for the punishment for the most stringent punishment for abortionists or women who participated in it, and we let them off easy. Okay, someone could say, well, that means that you don't really believe that abortion is murder, and because obviously, if you really believed it was, then you'd make it a capital crime or something like that. And I think the argument that I gave is, let's just say I would grant – I don't think this follows, by the way. I think there's nuanced ways of explaining it, so you wouldn't have to argue that way. But let's just say you're right. I'm completely inconsistent. That is, I'm giving two messages. I am saying with one message that abortion is murder, and I'm saying with another message abortion is not murder. Okay? All this observation by anyone else can do – is say that I'm being inconsistent. What you can't get from this is the real answer to the question, is abortion taking an innocent human life? This is just a reflection on my inconsistency. I know there's an attempt to say, well, you don't really believe it because deep down inside you have doubts about it, or else you would act this way. But to be fair, you're getting double signals. How do you break the tie? How do you know what really is the case? I'm saying two things. I'm saying it is murder. I'm saying it's not murder. That is the taking of an innocent human life without proper justification. You're not going to know the answer to that question, that is, breaking the tie, by looking at me. The only way you can know the answer to that question is by looking at abortion. And when you look at abortion, you look at the arguments against it, the ones that we've offered and other pro-lifers have offered, that abortion takes the life of an innocent human being, and it's wrong to take the life of innocent human beings for the reasons that people have abortions, and therefore abortion is wrong.
Right.
Now, that stands alone. That stands on its own. The argument stands regardless of whether any particular pro-lifer is consistent with the point or not. And I think that there may appear to be an inconsistency when there isn't one, in fact, and I write about this in that piece I mentioned about the punishment. You have the crime and then you have the punishment. First, you have to determine whether a crime is committed, whether something is wrong, and that's what we do in our arguments. So then you have to, as a matter of policy, decide what is the appropriate punishment for that crime. Listen, I'm capable of answering the first one. I've got the skills to do that. I don't have the skills of answering the second one. I don't know what is appropriate punishment. This takes a different set of skills. People who are good at that, politicians, lawmakers, they can judge that. And frankly, all taking of human life is not punished in the same way. You have extenuating circumstances. You have first-degree murder. You have second-degree murder. You have third-degree murder. You've got lying in wait. You've got all these different factors that need to be considered to determine what course of punishment is appropriate for the given crime. I'm not good at that. I admit that. But I don't have to be good at that to know whether abortion is wrong. And so I say let's let those people deal with that. Frankly, a lot of that work has already been done. Fetal homicide is actionable in this state except for the case of abortion. And they have the punishments right there in the statutes. You know, that work's already been done. Well, we're suggesting is if you want one way to solve it is just remove the abortion exception. And the doctor, probably the doctor is the one that's the most, in a sense, guilty because he doesn't have any personal circumstances that might be mitigating. You know, when you have women under stress and they do this and that and the other thing, well, this is considered mitigating circumstances for other crimes, and so it might be considered that here. But it is fair to keep the two distinct. And even if we argued that there's a total inconsistency and it's unjustifiable in the case of pro-lifers, all you can see there is the psychological inconsistency. You can't see anything about the moral action of abortion itself. Something else has got to break the tie of the two messages given by the pro-lifer, and that has to be the facts in question.
Yeah, I guess that's a typical thing that happens is people try to throw you off the real question.
Mm-hmm.
And put it on you or try to make, you know, it kind of, when I heard that question, I thought it made me feel guilty. Like, wow, I wouldn't. Maybe I really don't.
Well, I think there are good reasons why we wouldn't, maybe put them to death or go out and kill abortionists. And I have a number of pieces in our website that argue this. One of them is called Pro-Lifers on the Horns of a False Dilemma. And but the thing is, even if we can't nuance our approach, even if we say, yes, we think abortion is murder, and no, it's wrong to kill abortionists, and it's wrong, we wouldn't make this a capital crime, that seems to be inconsistent. Well, I grant, okay, great. So my testimony is inconsistent. Now what? When you have inconsistent testimony, it means that you're saying two different things, but it doesn't tell you which one's true.
Right.
You've got to look at the facts of the matter to break the tie.
Right. That helps a lot. Thank you very much.
Okay, it's good talking to you. I appreciate the call, Tom. Let's go to John. John, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, Greg.
Hi there.
I've been listening to your conversations, and I was going to touch base on those, but there's only so much time. So
yeah.
I was going to bring up something interesting. You know, your screener and I were discussing this.
Yeah.
It was a very interesting interview with Larry King on Wednesday. Raquel Welch guest starred on there.
No kidding. She's still around, huh?
Yep.
She was the bombshell from the late 60s and early 70s.
Right.
The big...
Still doing a lot of work as an actress and good work, too. And,
uh-huh. Well, good.
And, playing older parts, still very attractive, but very smart. And she talked about a lot of things. The one thing she talked about, and she brought this up, was the movie The Passion.
Mm-hmm.
And she said it was the most moving thing she'd ever seen. She said, you know, I was originally raised up a Christian, and then like a lot of people, you know, you get away from these things. You get caught up with your career and the whole thing. But she said, you know, and I didn't know if I could take it because she said I'm very easily jarred and jangled by violence.
Right.
But she said, I must say it was the most moving things I've ever seen. And she says, for those who say it was anti-Semitic, I know there's a lot of Jewish people who say that. She says, I disagree with them. She says, I don't get that. She said, Mel Gibson is a visionary. She said, and this is why we shouldn't pigeonhole people. She said, he was once called the sexiest guy in the world or whatever.
Yeah, right.
She said, but then on the other hand, who knew that he had this within him, this project that was there all along, and he builds it to fruition, and she admired him.
Right. Or the angst and the trauma and the depression that he went through 10 years
ago.
That and
she really said she admires him for the fact that he didn't cave into the critics, and she went through. He went through and did what he set out to do.
Right.
And then she said, you know, I went home. She said, and I opened up the Bible to see how closely his script in his movie, was aligned when I read the four Gospels early, and she said, and he got it down.
He did, right. Well, when you read all the Gospel accounts, you could probably read the Passion proper in, of all the Gospel accounts, you could probably read the whole thing in 20 minutes, you know.
Right.
So obviously you got a two-hour movie or whatever it was. You've got to take some creative license. But that's done with every historical account. You've got to put the stuff there that isn't included. But the salient details are there, of course.
Oh, yeah. She was defending that, and she said that and Larry King said, well, what was the message you got from the movie? She says, well, it was a number of things. Forgiveness, she said, salvation, she said, the gift of it, she said, and also being you know, also she says loving other people and being considerate of other people and not just being selfish. She says, mm-hmm. I'm guilty of that. She says, I've been in a business where I've been caught up in self-promoting and
sure.
so on. She says, but we really need to take this to heart. I mean, she said it with such conviction.
I'm glad that she made that point, the latter point, if I take your characterization.
Yeah, she said all those things.
Yeah, because it's really, it's not about kindness and mercy and love. It's about God's sacrifice through Jesus on our behalf and the forgiveness that flows from that if we understand it rightly and respond to it appropriately. And there is also this example of Jesus who is seeking to forgive those of his tormentors that are before him causing the crucifixion.
She talked about that. That's powerful.
But it's not the main deal, right?
Right. She talked about how was the way he was treated by the people and the cruelty that he endured and so on. But she said, you know, his example was about being kinder to other people and not being self-imbued with ourselves and caught up in all this sort of thing. But I was just very impressed with it's nice to see somebody when you see an interview like that that
right.
it's not just superficial stuff. There's some real substance.
Yeah, I'm really glad to hear that too. I thank you for the call and the information there about Larry King and Raquel Welch. I always wonder how he's going to respond too because he seems to be all over the board. Let's see. Let's go to Jim here in the waning moments of our show. Jim, you made it.
Hey, praise the Lord, Greg. How you doing?
I'm okay. Thank you. What's on your mind?
Yeah, first, let me just say I'm really blessed by your ministry because it makes me think and rethink about those, you know, quote-unquote sacred cow doctrines.
Uh-huh.
So I really appreciate that.
You're welcome.
My wife and I recently started attending like a Reformation type of church.
Mm-hmm.
And people there really seem to love our Lord and the pastor and what have you. Whatever.
Right.
But I noticed, like, they have women that are leading Bible studies where men are involved.
Mm-hmm.
Have like lay readers that are women.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in your opinion, would that be enough to leave a church? I know there's no.
No, I that doesn't bother me at all.
Really,
my assessment of particularly the First Timothy 2 and 3 passages, which are the more operative verses, is that when. I can just give you this quick thing. I'll tell you, first of all, you can go to women in the church or teaching women in the church or women teaching in the church or something like that
right.
on the web. I wrote a piece about this. So I'll give you the details, but let me give you a quick sketch.
Okay.
My take on the second chapter of 1 Timothy,
right.
where it says, and it's probably translated in your Bible, I do not allow a woman to teach or to exercise authority over a man, but to receive instruction with entire submissiveness.
Right.
I think that aner and gune, that man and woman there, are men, husband and wife. That's my take on that passage. And those are proper and appropriate ways of translating that passage. When you look at the details, for the women to receive teaching with entire submissiveness from men seems way out of line. Are you married?
Yes.
Then your wife would have to receive teaching from me with entire submissiveness.
Right.
You know, if we read that in that fashion. I think he's talking about the men being the leaders in the family, the spiritual leaders of the family of the wife, and the entire submissiveness goes to the husband-wife relationship. Now, so that means it doesn't prohibit women from teaching men, is the point I'm making. However, the next chapter talks about elders of the church, and there are no women mentioned in elders. There seem to be arguably in deacons, but not in elders. And I think this means that the leadership of the church proper is to be done by men. But that doesn't mean women can't be involved with ministry in the church, and it doesn't mean that women can't teach in the church. They can, and they're often gifted for that purpose. So sorry about the short shrift. We ran out of time. I just gave you a thumbnail sketch there, but go back to our go to our web and read that piece. And my thought has developed a little since I wrote that, and so I think when I wrote that, I was still uncertain about women in top leadership in the church. But I certainly think that women have the opportunity and the legitimacy of teaching in the church. Friends, I'll be back with you next week. All right, gotta go. But in the meantime, between now and then, be a good ambassador for Christ, and you go out and give them heaven, all right? Tell them Greg sent you. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. Bye-bye.